Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The latest news on bird flu just today, it's now in Sweden. Two wild ducks found infected. Two wild ducks in Sweden sounds almost sweetly distant. But there's nothing distant in the warnings Americans are hearing this week about bird flu. It will come to North America, probably within months, we're told. There's a 50-50 chance, we're told, it will jump to human-to-human transmission, the pandemic path. And then the ominous warning that bird flu could kill millions. The guidance from Washington this week, stash canned tuna under the bed. Up next on Point, a reality check and a serious conversation about preparing for bird flu. Nancy Shute covers health and medicine for U.S. News & World Report. She wrote about bird flu spreading its wings in this week's issue. She joins me now from Washington. Nancy, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
So here we are reading today, two wild ducks found in Sweden with bird flu. It goes on and on. Is there a front edge to this thing? What's the evidence of the spread?
Well, this epidemic has been transformed in the last 6 months, Tom. It's completely surprised the scientists. They did not expect it to go through the migratory birds like it has. Migratory birds have been known for over 100 years to have all kinds of bird flu, and it's never gotten them sick. This virus has clearly changed its spots and is acting in a very different, scary way.
We see now images of U.S. scientists standing in ice and water in Alaska, tracking bird flocks there. What are they looking for exactly, and what will it mean, Nancy, when we first find wild migratory birds in North America with evidence of the bird flu?
Well, we'd like to get as early a warning as possible as far as when this bug is on our continent. So the plan is that by monitoring our migratory birds, which go up north to the Arctic in the summer to breed, while they're there, they hang out with birds from Asia and from Europe who already have the virus. And so the odds are pretty good that when our birds come south in the fall, they'll have H5N1 with them.
What does that mean for wild bird populations in the lower 48, for domesticated birds, agriculture, farms, chickens, turkeys, all the rest? What does it mean when the migratory birds bring it down?
All really good questions. I talked a great deal with folks about our poultry industry last week, and people at CDC and elsewhere seem to feel that the U.S. poultry industry is in pretty good shape. They've been dealing with less lethal forms of bird flu for decades. They are now testing every single flock before it goes to slaughter. And also, almost all the birds are undercover. They're in buildings throughout their life, so the odds are much smaller that they would get infected by a migratory bird.
But if migratory birds have it, and if they're flying south, does that mean we'll be surrounded by a bird population that has it, whether it gets into commercial poultry farms or not?
Exactly. It's the kind of thing that we saw 5 or 6 years ago with West Nile virus, where it spread across the country. It killed a lot of birds. Some people got sick. And most of the migratory birds are now immune to it. The scary thing about bird flu is it's a much tougher virus. It's already killed almost 100 people in Asia and Turkey. And we don't know if this thing could mutate to the extent that it could spread easily from human to human. It could kick off a horrific pandemic, and that's what really has the experts scared.
Of course, it's that human-to-human transmission, as you say, that has everyone's eye glued. We've seen a report this week from Robert Webster at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, Memphis, Tennessee, saying 50-50 odds that it could go to human-to-human transmission, that he personally believes it will happen, that he's making personal preparations, storing food. He said on ABC News, society just can't accept the idea that 50% of the population could die. I mean, suddenly we're in very astronomical, head-spinning numbers there.
We are. You know, Bob Webster is the acknowledged world expert on bird flu, and so I think we should all take him seriously. I would also say that 50% number is way higher than most people are projecting. The estimates are with the 1918 pandemic, which was pretty darn bad, probably 10 to 20% mortality rate, which is still horrible. But
you've got a population of 300 million. There you're talking 30 to, you know, 60 million. I mean, that's still huge. I don't want to play too lightly with these numbers, but once a percentage like that is thrown out, everybody starts thinking.
Well, we should. I think that's the point that Webster and Mike Leavitt and these other folks are trying to make to us, is that we don't know if this is going to go ballistic and become a pandemic. That's what makes it so hard to plan. But if it does, we got to be prepared for some pretty bad stuff.
We're going to look at exactly what that preparation might entail. Nancy Shute, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Nancy Shute covers health and medicine for U.S. News and World Report. She spoke with me from Washington. We are talking this hour about bird flu, what you and the country should do to prepare. You can join the conversation. Are you stacking tuna under the bed? Do you sense a nightmare coming? Or is this overblown? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Dr. William Schaffner, chairman of the Department of Preventive Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University's School of Medicine. He's on the National Institutes of Health's Data Safety Oversight Committee for bird flu vaccine trials. Dr. Schaffner, thanks very much for being with us again.
Hello, Tom. Always good to be with you.
Well, give us some perspective here. First of all, on your Tennessee colleague Robert Marsh's observations there. It was on the network news last night. A lot of people are hearing this. I'd love to get your response. He thinks 50-50 odds of it going to human-to-human transmission. He says he personally believes it will happen. And then he threw this out. Society just can't accept the idea that 50% of the population could die. Speak to all that, if you would.
Let's do it one piece at a time. Yeah. Rob Webster is an acknowledged expert on bird flu, as Nancy just said.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, if we get 10 influenza experts around a table, you'll get about 12 opinions about how likely it is that this virus will develop the capacity to go from human to human.
Mm-hmm.
There are people at the other end of the spectrum who say, you know, this virus has spread so widely. It's been in so many birds. It's had so many opportunities to mutate, and it hasn't done it yet. And some of those experts are rather now quieted. In any event, we're stuck with the genetic statistical probabilities of what will happen. We're all waiting to see.
He thinks
we
that
all
a 50,
recognize.
He thinks a 50-50 chance. Where would you put it that it'll go human to human?
Yeah, 10% maybe.
Okay,
something like
okay.
That.
You're settling our heart rate a little, but still, that's a very real chance. What about his other comment, William Schaffner? Society just can't accept the idea that 50% of the population could die. What? Give us some context for that. What does that mean?
Yeah, let's take a deep breath about that.
Please.
The worst global pandemic we've ever had was indeed back in 1918, and the mortality rate there wasn't 10%. Most people think, and we have to have estimates, the data weren't very good back then, about 2%. But even that's striking because in normal influenza, which causes about 36,000 deaths in the United States on average each year, mm-hmm. it's considerably less than 1%. So it's going to be serious. How serious is something else? 50% is way, way, way high.
But 2%, if we've got a population of 300 million, that's 6 million people.
Yeah. It could be that bad. Now, let's put it in perspective. Mm-hmm. We had pandemics in 1957 and in 1968 that were not anywhere nearly this severe. So the virus itself can vary in the aggressiveness with which it will produce disease. And, of course, we don't know. Now, what people will say is, mm-hmm. look, in the folks that it's already infected that we know about, half of those people have died. And we must take that seriously. But usually in new infectious diseases, we first appreciate the most serious cases. As the new infectious agent moves out into the population, mortality rates begin to level off and then go down a little bit.
For a virus at this stage in its worldwide spread, is a 50% mortality rate typical or high?
It's high, and that is clearly one of the things that has brought this virus to everyone's attention. In addition to what Nancy said, this is a much more extensive bird flu virus spread than we have seen in the past. So both of those things are noteworthy, and that's why, quite prudently, we ought to try to prepare for it.
We're going to look at preparation, but let me just ask you, Dr. Schaffner, could this have been stopped, or is there an inevitability about this once it gets going?
Well, we tried to stop it, and there were blisters of, you might call it, bird flu back in 1997 in Hong Kong, where millions of chickens were killed. Mm. And we think that epidemic was indeed snuffed. It was stopped in its tracks. But this same virus then got into many more rural areas where it was impossible, really, to try and eliminate all the poultry, which in turn infected the wild birds. And so, although attempts were made in Vietnam more successfully than in China, for example.
On balance, this is soon a moot point, maybe already, probably, but did we do what we could, or could we have stopped before we're talking about the potential for millions of deaths just in this country?
Yeah, realistically speaking, I think we did what we could do, given the way our society is organized around the world.
We've been talking with Dr. William Schaffner at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He's been right in the thick of looking at vaccine work on this. We're joined as well now from New York by Dr. Erwin Redlener. He's Associate Dean and Director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Dr. Redlener, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Hi, how are you doing, Tom?
We're well, and we're really looking forward to hearing you and Bill Schaffner talk this through, because it's got all of our attention now. Where does your concern level stand? I mean, the public suddenly being told to put food under the bed. We're hearing big numbers about the odds of it happening and about the death toll that could result. Is this justified alarm at this point?
Well, first of all, I don't know that I'd use the word alarm, but I do think that the pandemic possibility is one of the most important large-scale public health threats we currently face. And while I don't think this is a cause for panic, I absolutely think that we are extraordinarily ill-prepared at this moment to deal with such a public health crisis and all of its ramifications. So that I think we have a lot of catching up to do, and I think this ought to be, we ought to be in very much high gear in getting ourselves together and figuring out what we can do in this very strange period of time now, because we are facing a threat of really undetermined size, exactly, except that we can make some predictions or guesses about how devastating it could be. And also, we don't really know much about when we actually might see a pandemic erupting, although I think most of us agree that it's fairly inevitable that it will happen. But the reason that it's a strange time period, Tom, is because we're in this phase now before we have the upgraded ability to develop and mass-produce appropriate vaccines, and we also don't have sufficient reliable antiviral medications that could treat people. So that all we have in the short run now is what people themselves can do as individuals, but most importantly, what our health and public health systems need to do to make sure we're as prepared as possible to take care of a lot of people who could be pretty sick.
But yet everything we read tells us that we're way short of being prepared. I want to be very concrete in this hour, because people's questions have become very concrete. First of all, on timetable, Erwin Redlener, how do you see the range? You say it's inevitable. So as soon as when, as late as when, what kind of timetable?
Well, the most recent predictions for the virus arriving here in birds now, and I'm emphasizing in birds, not necessarily in a form that's easily transmissible among people, from the World Health Organization is suggesting that's, you know, 6 to 12 months. And then, of course, the caveat is it could be a little sooner than that, it could be later than that. But basically, I think we're seeing no way out of the of the United States, for example, experiencing birds with H5N1 type virus infecting them. And so I think we'll have within our borders birds and poultry affected at some point within that time frame, let's say within a year. And by the way, and Dr. Schaffner probably mentioned this already, but there is no particular seasonality of this flu. So it's not like we're going to maybe dodge a bullet and be out of flu season and then, you know, we'll be in the summer, everything's fine. I think we can see this particular kind of virus erupt really at any time. So there is no specific seasonality to this. So we're talking about a period where we could have, and we could have lingering virus just among birds for some prolonged period of time. We could have a situation where it's among birds, starts to spread to a few people, and that'll make everyone very worried. It could have much less lethal consequences than it currently has. We just don't know. On the other hand, we could see in 3, 4, 5, 6 months from now, all of a sudden the virus transforming itself so it can be easily transmitted. A lot of people getting very sick and very rapidly see our public health system pretty much overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. So we have this big range, and it's really hard to know exactly what to do, except there are some concrete things we would like government to do, for example.
We'll look at those. William Schaffner first, though. So there's the ambiguity of the timetable, but as Erwin Redlener says, it could happen. It could switch quickly to human-to-human transmission at some point. That's the point people are focused on. At that point, speak to us for a moment about vaccines. Will there be vaccination? Will there be a vaccine that works? Or are we going to have a vulnerable window of how long? What's that look like?
Well, Tom, when it comes to vaccines, the government is doing good stuff. It's contracted with all of the major influenza vaccine manufacturers to produce a bird flu vaccine and to get those into clinical trials. And those clinical trials are underway to let us know how many doses will be required to protect the population, how strong the vaccine has to be in each dose, whether adjuvants will work, will the vaccine work, and how effectively in children as well as in older adults. And indeed, the secretary has already said that he's authorized the production of the second-generation vaccine. And while this testing is all going on, we're manufacturing bird flu vaccine and stockpiling it.
So what's the best-case situation? Might we all be vaccinated before this ever unfolds, or is that completely unrealistic?
I think that's unrealistic, but I think we will have a large stockpile of vaccine. Of course, the sooner the transformation occurs, if it does occur to affect humans, the less vaccine we'll have on hand.
Will there still be a window of naked vulnerability in any circumstance here?
Well, unlikely. Remember, if the tone of one's questions are, can we expect to stop this and avoid a pandemic completely? That's unlikely. You can't stop the hurricane.
Yep.
We're all in the business of coping, right, to
yep.
try to make the best of a very difficult situation.
But I guess I just put yourself in an ordinary citizen's shoes. They're hearing that a deadly flu could come. They want to know how soon will I and my family be able to get vaccinated against it, and how long will we be vulnerable? What's your answer?
We will have vaccine available, and it will be given in a prioritized fashion. And the CDC and medical ethicists and other public health authorities have worked out a scheme. Healthcare workers are near the top of the list. The frail elderly are near the top of the list. Then public safety workers, fire and police, and then the general population.
That's me. How long do I have to wait? Months? Is my family going to be vulnerable for years? Months? What?
It all depends on how much vaccine we have in the stockpile. It could be as short as weeks or as long as months.
So there's the window. I want to begin to bring our listeners and their questions in. Kevin's calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think it's a little disingenuous to make light of it by talking about stocking tuna under the bed.
Well, it's not intended to be entirely light. I mean, people are talking about disrupted food stocks, and you may be happy for tuna under the bed. It's just the under the bed does have a ring of humor to it. But how are you looking at the whole thing, Kevin?
I've got a bachelor's and master's degrees, you know, in environmental management. I go to places like avianflutalk.com, and my first thought was these people are nuts. And now I'm one of them.
So what are you doing?
The latest preparations are I'm considering adding one or two extra fuel tanks in the basement for heating fuel. I'm considering a generator. And I'm assuming that I will need a year's worth of food.
A year? That's starting to sound survivalist. A year?
Yes.
And are you doing it? Are you beginning to stack it up, Kevin?
Yes, I am.
And do you feel absurd or do you feel realistic?
I feel scared.
Yeah, we can relate to that. Kevin, thank you for your call. Erwin Redlener, here's one citizen. You hear what he's beginning to do. Is this reasonable or is this out of the park?
I personally would never recommend that people need to stockpile for a year. I think that's presupposes a condition or set of conditions in our society that I actually don't think would materialize. Certainly not from pandemic flu.
But we've got Robert Webster saying he's storing a 3-month supply of food and water at his home. He's a flu expert, and that sounds like a lot of food and water.
It is a tremendous amount of food and water, and I think, you know, what's interesting here is before we started talking about pandemic flu, if you go to the websites like the FEMA website or Red Cross, where they're talking about general preparedness, not pandemic, we're talking about 3 days of food and water and other supplies, et cetera. And then recently the CDC and others have been talking about a 2-week stockpiling, and I guess and it depends on your sense of how severe this is going to be. It is very possible that if we get a severe pandemic, that food supplies and other vital needs, those supply chains will be interrupted, and so a 2-week supply might make sense. On the other hand, you know, I have my own kids living in tiny little apartments in New York City, and I don't even know where they would put 2 weeks worth of supplies. And we have to have some rational balance of what we might expect. I think that for people to say it's just not going to happen, I'm not going to do anything, is not reasonable, and I think a year is too long. So I think, you know, if people can do it and you can stockpile a week to two of foods that you can then rotate, in other words, consume them and replace them, I don't think that's such a terrible thing to do. But what's important about all this, Tom, is that we don't want to create an environment of panic here where we
absolutely
do have a sort of survivalist tone to the thing. I think we need to do what's prudent. It's like, you know, it's like in the putting smoke alarms in your house. Yes, we do want to make that investment. We do want to be safe about it, but we don't want to become obsessed with creating a wall of security around ourselves. Now, we still want our kids not to be frightened by this. We want to go about our business as usual.
But if it comes, it's going to be frightening, and I think people are coming from kind of a standing start here in most households.
Oh, yeah, I know. This is why I'm saying I'm not trying to underplay this. I'm just reacting to somebody talking about a year.
Yep, that's a long time.
Yeah, I think that everyone should be thinking about what they might do. And then there's some other things that we're going to want to learn about in terms of personal hygiene and what during a flu season that's potentially a pandemic flu, you know, what do we want to do in terms of avoiding the possibility of getting infected, in terms of avoiding being in places with crowds. And
this whole idea of social distancing, we'll talk about that. But first, let me get Judy calling from Nashville. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I am heartened that I'm hearing two people from Vanderbilt talking about this and knowing so much about it. I live about 2 blocks or 3 from Vanderbilt Hospital.
William Shafter from Vanderbilt, Erwin Redlener from Columbia, but Bill's next door to you.
I'm up in New York.
Yeah. What's your question, Judy?
Well, I'm curious, if you live in a city that has these people working on this, are you better off? Or because you are in a city, are you less well off because of, you know, panic and so many people trying to get whatever there will be to get?
That's an interesting question. Bill Shafter, better off in an urban area where you've got more facilities or up on a mountaintop somewhere away from people?
Oh, golly, tough question. I would think marginally, if you're in a small community, you're somewhat better off than if you're in a big city, just because the opportunity for spread of the virus from person to person in a large city is much more evident. I'm with Professor Redlener entirely. I think we shouldn't panic, and the degree of concern you have will tell you how much you ought to personally prepare around your home. I also like to emphasize what we can do personally. You know, people who are overweight, have their diabetes not under control, have uncontrolled high blood pressure and the like, if they get infected with even the annual influenza virus, are more likely to develop the complications. So getting being responsible ourselves for our personal health will help. And then, of course, we will do social distancing, and we want to wash our hands almost constantly because that will help reduce the chance that we'll acquire infection.
Social distancing, the idea of staying away from other people, we hear in earlier pandemics, some people just kind of boarded themselves up in their homes and didn't come out till it passed by, but then most of us have to make a living. So we're wondering what companies are going to do. On the phone with us now from Clinton, Massachusetts, is Alfred Cotton. He's director of corporate image at Nipro. It's a global plastics company with plants in 18 countries, including in Southeast Asia. He's got plants in the U.S., in North Carolina, Chicago, Detroit, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Oregon, Texas, all over the place. He spearheaded the company's avian flu preparedness plan. Mr. Cotton, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
So if it comes, and if it's transmitting human to human, here you are. You've got a big business to do. What do you do? Do you shut down? How do you respond?
Well, we have had a little experience in this type of thing with SARS when SARS hit China.
Hit Toronto, killed 40 people.
Right. We have 8,000 people in China. And we have a similar plan to what we put together for SARS. And our plan in China for SARS was successful in to the extent that none of our employees and none of their family members contracted SARS.
So if it comes, what are you going to say to your employees? Come to work, stay home? What will they do differently?
Well, you start now in cleaning up your operation. I mean,
What does that mean?
You just make sure that you have a very clean environment, because any kind of filth in any place, warehouses or whatever, that helps to spread disease. So from an industrial point of view, you take what the industry is called the five S's, and one of those is safety, and you just make sure that you have a very clean operation.
But one person with the flu is going to be unclean. How do you know? Do people come to work? Do you test them if they come?
No, then the second thing you need to do, and we have done this in China already, for this time, because right now we're taking most of our measures in Eastern Europe and in Asia, because that's where it is right now. And we have, for every facility, we have a thermal imaging device, which is basically a wireless thermometer.
At the front door, tells you if they've got a fever walking in?
Right. Correct.
If they do you send them home?
Yes. Well, no, you send them a doctor. But if they do, you immediately find out why they have an elevated temperature.
And what about the rest of your employees? They may not want to go out. They may not want to go to work for fear of contracting the flu. What's going to be your message to them? Come to work?
Well, nobody's going to tell them they have to. There's always a safety issue, and you are always the best monitor of your own safety.
But if they want to get paid, presumably they'll have to.
I mean, I think that the country of China went through SARS with only temporary disruptions, and obviously, if you have a doomsday scenario, mm-hmm. the result is doomsday, and mm-hmm. you can't plan for doomsday. But anything short of doomsday, the other thing you do, we have stocked all of our facilities now with masks. Mm-hmm. With hand sanitizers.
Alfred Cotton, thanks for being with us. We've been joined from Nashville, Tennessee, by Dr. William Schaffner, the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, from New York by Dr. Erwin Redlener at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. Right now, Pauline is calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Hi, Pauline, you're on the air.
Yes, Carpe diem, gentlemen of higher learning.
Seize the day. Okay, we're ready. Which way?
I just want to give my kudos and thankfulness for their years they spent in the education. And my poignant concern question is, it may sound silly, but I listen intently 24/7 to NPR.
There's nothing silly these days around this. What's your question?
Okay, I have a cat, which is a mammal.
Yep.
Okay, has a propensity to introduce into her diet birds.
Yeah, we know how cats work.
Yeah, but this one I have a canary bell on that I'm going to have to accelerate to a cowbell.
So are you concerned for your cat's health or for your health? Or where's your worry lie, Pauline?
Okay, in our northern hemisphere, the propensity, you know, the logistics. We're going to be looking forward to summer open barbecue. The cats hightailing it out of the hills. And you can kind of know that she's going to bring down a bird.
So what does that mean in terms of bird flu? Let us look at exactly that. Erwin Redlener, first to you, if I may. We heard about cats in Germany, as I recall, who came down with this H5N1. Pauline's got a cat. So if it comes, what about pets, cats,
well,
bird
eaters?
Well,
there have been some sporadic cases like you just mentioned about cats. But I think
Bill Schaffner, do you what's your sense about that? You're more into the viral aspects of this.
Erwin, I think that Miss Pauline represents a lot of cat owners, and there are millions of them out there.
And I'm not one, so
Well, we have one in our home, and I was asked the same question by my wife.
Yeah.
The indoor cats we don't have to worry about, but those outdoor cats. And I think the risk of this is so low that it will be an occasional event, but not a common one. This is still a virus that doesn't like to go from birds to mammals. And as we now know, it can occasionally get into a person. It can get into an occasional cat. And there have been tigers in Thailand also that have been affected. It's not a big deal. The better thing to do is what Ms. Pauline has suggested, put a bell on that cat so it doesn't get anywhere near the birds.
Will the cat be a danger to itself if it's eating bird, or also a danger to its owner?
Well, the cat in Germany was discovered because it died, and it died right close to where there were dead birds from H5N1. So it can cause illness in cats, clearly.
Could it at some point be a risk to its owner? And for that matter, what about pet birds? Are we going to see Americans, shipping the birds out of the cage, out of the house, shipping cats off to I don't know where?
It's happened in Germany already. Owners have started to bring cats into the German equivalent of the ASPCA. Right. And so there will be some concern about that. I don't think it will be a big problem. And once again, as Erwin has said, don't panic, stay cool, take care of your animal by yourself.
Are pet birds safe in the house if they're in a cage and not interacting with wild birds outside? Or do they somehow just draw the virus bird to bird?
No, they're safe. They're safe. There has to be really direct contact or direct contact with the bird's droppings.
Well, so just a million questions coming here. Erwin, you mentioned earlier your concern about our public health preparedness.
Yeah.
Where do you think that stands? We've read there aren't going to be enough respirator machines.
Yeah, ventilators, right.
Ventilators, just for starters. Is the government doing what it can? Has it done what it should?
Well, you know, here's interestingly, what has happened is that, and Bill, I think, talked about this earlier. We've known about some form of avian flu for many years now. We're talking about, 8 or 9 years that we've been that this process has actually begun. It really has just gotten our attention starting, I'd say, last spring, last summer, where it took a while, but I think the government on the federal level, certainly, and maybe all levels of government, has gotten the point, and the rhetoric is, as far as I'm concerned, it matches the level of concern we'd like to see. So Secretary Leavitt and the whole infrastructure of federal government is, in a sense, on the case.
But we get the sense from the government that they don't have the numbers of anything. They were saying, and Leavitt was saying before Congress, hey, if it comes, you're on your own, individual communities, to get ventilators, masks, gauze, gloves.
Yeah.
We had Judd Gregg in New Hampshire saying, wait a minute, I thought we appropriated billions for...
I know, This is what I was going to say, is that right now, so the rhetoric is geared up. It's not matched by the resources. This is what the problem is right now, that we have people are saying the right words, but we're getting an extraordinarily inadequate amount of money, basically, to support the kind of medical system and the supplies that we will actually need. The majority of the appropriations so far have been made that have been made on pandemic flu are for vaccine development and for stockpiling of antivirals. Less than 10% of the total money has been designated to help the hospitals, local hospitals, and local health departments gear up. And that's where we have a impending crisis here of enormous proportions.
And so we've got a shortfall of things that we need. And how is it going to be determined who gets the help if and when a pandemic comes? There's not enough antiviral. There won't be enough vaccine at first. There won't be enough respirators. Is it going to be a lottery? I mean, can we really prioritize every American? How are you going to determine? Is it a free-for-all?
We're going to have some bioethical pandemonium here, because the problem is we have no idea really how to make those decisions on the ground. We had this discussion in my own family the other day. The ventilator supply is so short that decisions will have to be made by doctors in hospitals to potentially take people off ventilators who they think might not make it, to give it to somebody who might make it. And those kinds of decisions will have an unbelievable impact. We're not even prepared to discuss the ethics of those questions, no less fix the supply problem.
But it sounds like high time. I want to get a local view on one city's efforts. Joining us from Denver, Colorado, is Jennifer Steck, a captain with the Denver Police Department. She works with the Colorado Ready public awareness campaign. It's an information clearinghouse with tips on preparing for disasters, including bird flu. Captain Steck, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Are you ready for the bird flu in Denver?
We are working together with a lot of different organizations, our Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, Citizens Corps, Colorado State University, Red Cross, a number of the different agencies that would play key roles in an event of this nature to try and pull together the latest and greatest information for the public.
Sounds good. How close to ready are you? I mean, realistically, is it going to be pandemonium, or are you on top of it? Can you hope to be on top of it?
Well, as I said, we've pulled a lot of people together. Are we ready? I think that's always a difficult question to answer. I think we're making progress. If it occurred today, would we be on top of everything? Probably not. But the progress is occurring even daily as we speak with the key officials. Mm-hmm. We've established a readycolorado.com website where the public can go for the latest and greatest information. So we try and direct them to credible sources of information so that they can at least update themselves and educate themselves on what's available.
Captain Steck, what are you recommending Coloradans do now in their own families, their own homes, their own lives?
Well, I think the key, and we've heard this, geez, since 9/11, I guess, and that is to have a ready kit at home. So make sure you can cover at least the 72 hours. And now we're hearing from Red Cross that they're suggesting a 10-day food supply. I think that's where the canned tuna and the powdered milk comes from, is to make sure that you have enough at home to take care of things and that all your family members have a clear idea on who they need to call if they're in different locations away from home, maybe somebody outside the area, so that they can make sure that they're all safe if they can't get to the same location.
Are you presuming that water and power may go out, that workers won't show up and that suddenly there won't be water in the tap or may not be power in the electric lines?
Worst case scenario, that could be a possibility. And as we're working to educate the public, we're also working very hard to educate first responders, other people that will truly need to come into work if we can make that happen, on what the risks are, how they can be prepared so that they can come into work being very confident that their family members are safe.
Mm. Jennifer Steck, captain with the Denver Police Department, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You can learn more about their program at our website. There's a link to all the information there, onpointradio.org. Pat's calling from Boston. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you doing today?
We're all right, we think. What do you think, Pat?
I've been following this for a while, and I'm looking at one of the things I see as an Achilles heel is the government must deal with the economic issues proactively with foreclosures, et cetera, school closings, group gatherings. Most Americans, I don't think, could survive economically for 2 weeks without pay at this point.
And we saw in Toronto, when SARS came there, 40 deaths and an enormous economic price tag. Let us pick that up. Irwin Redliner, yep. First to you. I mean, what is this going to look like? Are companies still going to ask everyone to congregate at work? Will people stay home? Is staying home the best way to stay alive? What about the economic impact?
Yeah, there's not only economic impact, there's educational impact, social impact, everything you can think of. This starts out as a public health issue, but rapidly gets into all the other sectors immediately. For example, government is talking about snow days, which is a euphemism for closing school for a prolonged period of time, because schools and contact among children is a really, you know, is going to be an important way to spread the virus.
But so, how many snow days? A week's worth? A month?
We're talking
3 months?
Potentially many weeks worth. Many weeks worth. So that means that that parents, even if they're not sick, are going to have to figure out how they're going to have the kids cared for, and it can't be in congregate situations. So mostly we're going to see parents having to stay out of the workplace, and with you know, sort of cascading effects now into the economy, both on a
for
family
weeks,
basis.
Would the government then forbid their being fired for staying home, or how do you picture that unfolding?
Well, none of that has actually been worked out yet. There is no way, no mechanism, for example, for the government either guaranteeing the income of people that have to stay home so that they can survive, or of compensating the you know, employers for the loss of their economic resources during that period either. So there's a lot of this has just simply not been thought through. And I think the idea is that we would hopefully try to keep those days of absolute serious concern about spread down to a minimum as best we can, and keep those days of disruption as minimized as we possibly can. But it's going to be a tough go. And but on the other hand, I think we'll get through whatever it is. It's just, can we get through it with the minimum amount of disruption to people, a minimum amount of illness, and a minimum amount of economic consequence?
Bill Schaffner, how do you see those social distancing goals playing out at work and school? I mean, will it be important just to stay away from other people? And how does society work if everybody stays home?
We'll all be coping, because it is very important. And we'll be doing the things, the recreational things, we'll be avoiding, going to concerts, going to the malls.
That's relatively easy compared to work, I guess.
Exactly. So remember, if you expect perfection, we're going to be disappointed. We're going to be all coping. School days, absolutely. Schools will be closed from time to time in the community, and in conjunction with the health department, people will be trying to keep that to an absolute minimum. Some people will be able to work at home. Some people will start work earlier, others later in the day, in order to minimize congregation. And so we'll all be engaged in coping. We did pretty well in 1957 and 1968. There was turbulence, but there was not huge economic impact. I think the implications today economically are potentially more serious, but we'll all be in a coping strategy trying to make it work.
Exactly.
We've just got a couple of minutes here. I want to ask each of you about the preparations you are making or envision in your own household. Erwin Redlener, first to you. What's your family doing, and how are you preparing now? How are you envisioning a time when a pandemic might come?
Well, I live in a neighborhood where actually couple of my older children, my brother and my mother live, and my grandchildren are here too. So we've had some family discussions about what is it that we want to do in terms of how we would. We're fortunate, since we have some extended family, that we can have assistance from our own family members in terms of watching children, making sure that people have the stocks that they need. We're going to try to get towards a 10-day to 2-week supply of food and water and medications. By the way, I should also add in there,
such as.
Well, I'm talking about people's personal medications.
I see. Right.
Chronic medication for blood pressure, cholesterol, and all that, to make sure that you have whatever you need for that can last for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're doing at the moment. And the other thing is the point that I think Bill made earlier about staying healthy. And I'm a pediatrician originally, and so we're into that notion of making sure that people are as healthy as they can be. People should be getting their regular flu shots. People who are at risk may want to be getting their shots that can help prevent certain kinds of pneumonia from bacteria called Pneumovax, which we think can be a complication of influenza. And we think those people who can get that should get that also. So there are medical things that individuals should do. There's information about taking care of yourself and hand washing and all that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the issue of stockpiling. And then we just have to plan our summer vacation and think about living our lives.
Living
until
right
we get
now.
To the next level.
Bill Schaffner, we just got another minute. How about your family? How about you? How are you preparing?
Well, our family sounds very much like Irwin's. We're doing all those same things. I would emphasize for the listeners that try to get a little supply of the medications that you need in stock at home, because that will be very important. Our communications mechanism in the family is well established. We've thought about that. We're literally clearing out a closet in order to stock some food and water, just as Erwin is doing. And then my wife particularly is getting used to the notion that I'll be going toward the problem. I'll be going in and working with public health and working in the hospital, and she's adjusting to that.
Has she got a separate bedroom ready for you, mister?
Well, I may be shacking up in the hospital some nights.
Yeah, a lot of strange situations. Erwin Redlener, I hear you there.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah.
I guess we're not going to solve this one, but you've painted a picture of what may be coming and what we may need to do when it comes. There will be many more conversations on this front, but this has been very valuable to me. I'm very grateful to both of you for being with us. Erwin Redlener at the Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, Dr. Red Leonard, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us. Yep.
And Dr. William Schaffner, Chairman of the Department of Preventive Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Bill Schaffner, you're always an informative and comforting voice. We thank you for being with us today.
Best to you, Tom, and to Irwin.
Listeners, be prepared. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.